Hi, my name is Sarah Ash, and I'm a reporter-producer for the Texas Standard. I usually would not call myself a sports fan, but I grew up watching soccer. One of my favorite stories I've reported looked at how women's soccer specifically is growing in popularity in Texas and across the country. Listen anytime to the Texas Standard wherever you get your podcasts.
From KUT
and KUTX
Studios.
Thanks for calling from McDonald's. This is Dolores. Am I direct your call?
Hi. Could you direct my call to George Saunders' room?
I sure can, sir. I just talked to him.
Oh, you did?
Uh-huh. Thank you. One moment.
All day beverages and snacks.
Yeah.
This is Owen Edgerton, and welcome to The Write-Up, a KUT-produced podcast featuring writers and what inspires them. In speaking of today's guest, Thomas Pynchon said, he's an outstanding tune voice, graceful, dark, authentic, and funny, telling just the kind of stories we need to get us through these times. Today's guest is George Saunders. He's the author of the short story collections Pastoralia, Civil War Land and Bad Decline, and The 10th of December, and also the nonfiction essay collection The Brain Dead Megaphone, and most recently his debut novel, Lincoln in the Bardo. Today on The Write-Up, we'll discuss compassion, craft, and capturing both the horror and the beauty of our world. It's a great thrill to have as our guest today, George Saunders.
Hello.
Hi, George. This is Owen.
Hey, Owen. How are you doing, buddy?
I'm doing really well. How about yourself?
I'm all right.
Well, let me ask you about this book. You know, of course, your first novel, Lincoln in the Bardo, which first, actually, let me just say, George, congratulations. It is such a beautiful book.
Oh, thank you, man. Thank you very much.
There's so many entry points into this book. Of course, there's the person of Lincoln, and there's the theme of grief. There's the concept of the afterlife or the conversation of ghosts. What was your entry point into the novel? What was your entry point in the story as a writer?
Well, you know, it was that anecdote that I heard years ago about Lincoln having entered into his son's crypt. That was something I carried around for about 20 years. But, you know, honestly, I think it was, for me, the true entry point was kind of an expectation or a hope that I had for what I would call surface tension. So, in other words, there's the themes and there's the emotional stuff and the facts and all that. But for me, what kind of day-to-day, what I found myself interested in and kind of loving was the new form, the kind of strange form, and then finding out what kind of opportunities that form made to make what I'm thinking of as surface tension. So, kind of like, you know, you pick up something and you start reading and you're either snapped into it or you're not. And as you're reading, certain surprising things happen as a result of language, maybe juxtapositions. It's actually kind of hard stuff to talk about, but writers, you know, like we know that a thing either has that kind of surface appeal or it doesn't. Mm. So that was where, to be honest, where most of my energy was going, trying to discover the new form, trying to refine it, trying to find out where the hidden pockets of heat were in it. That was what sustained me day to day. Basically, in a certain way, trying to steer clear of banality, trying to steer clear of the pitfalls of, for example, an historical novel or a novel about Lincoln or a novel with ghosts in it. So that was, you know, every day I'd go in and read what I had and just kind of feel if I was, you know, moving into kind of too familiar a territory or also too vague of territory, and then just course correct. And I think all the thematic stuff and the moral ethical stuff kind of happened on the side. But for me, it was sort of that feeling that this was an odd form that I was kind of inventing, and that was also, my hope was that all of the innovations would have something to do with emotional power and not just with technical showing off, I guess, you know.
Right. And when you talk about that, the surface tension, I mean, I often find in a book is especially a book which is multiple voices, is the sort of juxtaposition of different voices and how they kind of slam against each other, which of course happens in Lincoln in the Bardo. But there's actually a lot of beautiful coming together of voices.
Yeah.
And that seems to have its own heat.
Yeah, well, that, I mean, again, that's sort of the, you know, the, I kept, as I was writing it, I was kind of thinking a little bit of musicality, you know, the way that you can, I don't know, a text has a sound, actually. It's not actually, it doesn't necessarily mean read aloud, but as you're scanning a text, I think there's a kind of a sound that it produces in your head, or a kind of a, you know, the, I guess the neurological equivalent of sound. So that was something I was really thinking about. And I didn't, you know, because the material was strange and the form was new, it was kind of cool. It was kind of like going to a new country you've never been before and kind of going, okay, what's beautiful here?
Yeah.
You know, what's jarring? What's interesting? Without a lot of preconceptions about what you were going to find. So, you know, you'd stumble on certain moments in the book and go, oh, God, that's kind of cool. You know, there was a lot of that. And that was a nice thing after all the years of writing stories where I think in the story form, you know, it's a little more familiar to me, and I kind of know most times in a vague way what's around the corner. But with this one, it was just all kind of new, and that was, it was that bit of what they, in Zen tradition they call beginner mind, that was really wonderful to just say, well, you know, I have no idea what I'm doing here. These tools are unfamiliar to me, but, the, you know, the base assumption is I know beauty when I see it, or I know, you know, coolness when I see it, or edge. So that was, I mean, I know I'm being a little bit vague, but I'm also trying to be truthful because talking to another writer, you can be a little more both frank and vague, I guess.
Well, you know, I heard you talking in an interview with Mashable, and you were mentioning the idea of looking, especially with, when you're considering the ghost, like you'd look to a ghost and say, all right, what is this story? What is this addition? What is this voice adding? And I was in the book reading the book, there is this feeling of discovery there. And for me, I mean, even as I was reading it, it was as if the cemetery was being colored in as the book extended.
Exactly.
And these voices would come in at just the right times, like when the barons come in, and you're like, oh gosh, yeah, I didn't know I wanted that voice right now, but that's perfect.
Right. Yeah. No, there was a lot of that because, you know, one of the dangers of this material is that it's super sad. Also, that it has that sort of, you know, buzzkill of historical fiction, where in your zest to kind of get it right, you end up getting it too right. In other words, you become slavishly devoted to verisimilitude. So I think that was part of the benefit of reading it. I don't know if I read it every day, but just about every day, certainly every other day, I'd start from the beginning and read. Part of that is you can feel what the reader is wanting. You know, if it gets a little too serious, you can feel that the reader would be happy to get some levity. If there's too many ghosts and if they're hard to keep in mind, you kind of know that some have to be cut. So that's really, for me, the main move in writing is just to kind of have some, at least try to have some sense of where your reader might be, and then reward her by making whatever changes she might need. But, you know, the other thing that was, I liked what you said about the graveyard being colored in, and I was thinking, you know, at this stage, I have talked about this book a lot, and to be honest, none of the things I've said have been exactly right because it's for me, it's a primarily intuitive thing. But I was thinking yesterday that, you know, about maybe 3 or 4 years ago, I did a story for GQ where I went to live in this homeless camp for, incognito for a week in Fresno. And it's kind of occurring to me that that project had a lot to do with this book because it was, you know, a short time. It was a week, and it was a very confined space because this homeless camp was in an old train yard, and it actually was had a fence around it, and it was also a very small cast. I knew about 6 or 7 people that I, you know, was kind of hanging around with, and while I was there, I had this really kind of, I don't know, to me it's a novelistic feeling that I trace back a little bit to Steinbeck's Cannery Row and Sweet Thursday, that idea of a confined physical space that then you can inhabit and kind of, it starts to almost become metaphorical because there's only 2 or 3 distinct locales within it. Likewise with the characters, you know, your people keep crossing your path again and again. So I had that experience at this homeless camp, and I remember at one point thinking, oh, God, this would be a really cool novel for that exactly that reason. For various reasons, I didn't do that, but I think I was drawing a lot on that in this book, especially because a lot of the people I met in the homeless camp were so they spend a lot of time rationalizing their presence there,
yeah.
just as the ghosts do in this book. So everybody had a sort of a central narrative that they would often tell you two or three times, having forgotten that they told you about it. And the gist of that narrative was always kind of, here's why I'm the only sane one in here, you know. Also some a lot of quality of grievance, you know, like I shouldn't be here, I'm a better person than this, but here's what happened to me. So I don't know the... It never occurred to me while I was writing the book, but I think a lot of that was really helpful, you know, to have a kind of a... It was almost like a Bardo on Earth, you know, these sweet people who were stuck in this terrible place and trying to figure out why they were stuck there and trying to figure out how they could get out. And in that scenario, I'm basically the Willie Lincoln who's
yeah.
there temporarily, and they're seeing me as kind of an emissary from the world they want to get back to.
And the same way, they're desperate to tell their story.
Right. And the telling, you know, of course, in a place like that, there's a lot of addiction issues and there's some mental health issues. But there was a very marked tendency to tell the same story over and over again. There's only, you know, almost as if the person had been reduced to two or three handy narratives that were always somehow rationalization stories.
Yeah, I mean that one of the most haunting aspects of Lincoln and the Bardo is that idea that there are people who have been in this graveyard who are stuck in their story in such a way that almost every other aspect of their life maybe is rotten away or it's gone. They've forgotten so many aspects of their life. And
right. And I had, you know, that while getting into that, I had that uncanny sense that that's not so different from us.
Yeah.
We conceptualize ourselves as good writers or good husbands or fathers or mothers, whatever. And of course that's right. That's how we do it. But those narratives are self-constructed, and they're often somewhat in conflict with reality. And so sanity would consist in the sort of reasonable revision of those narratives every now and then.
Yeah.
As well as the changing of our actions so that, in fact, we really were good husbands and good fathers and good writers.
Right.
So I think it's not, you know, there was a kind of a nice moment when I thought, well, actually, I'm not really writing about dead people. I mean, these dead people are in a sort of exaggerated form of humanity, but they're not so different from us.
Yeah. No, that totally comes through. And actually, it's interesting. In you've done in your nonfiction writing, the article about the homeless camp, but also in your article about the Texas border, Texas Mexican border, and of course the New Yorker piece where you visited candidate Trump's rally. You have this a drive to look into someone's story that is radically different than your own, and say, how can I understand that?
Yeah.
It occurred to me actually. There's some beautiful moments in the book where a ghost enters into another ghost or into a living person, and for a few moments is there within that other person, and then comes out almost ecstatically empathizing with that person. Those moments really struck me because it seems that maybe also that describes what a good writer can do. Is to step into another person's soul and then walk away understanding them in a deeper sense?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, that is what I hope to do in writing, and certainly in those nonfiction pieces. That's it. You know, honestly, it's just my nature. I like I don't know why exactly. I mean, it just might be dispositional, but I'm always interested to try to get to know somebody better, especially if I don't agree with them. Maybe it's just that I don't like conflict. So if somebody starts arguing with me and I'm against them, it's more comfortable for me to say, all right, well, let me ask you about this. Let me try. I like that move of trying to befriend somebody who maybe doesn't like you. I mean, that might be really dysfunctional, but I like that. And then even though it doesn't, you know, like in, for example, in the Trump rallies, I don't think I ever changed somebody's mind. I know I didn't.
Yeah.
But I did like the softening of the discourse that took place. And maybe, again, just as self-reassurance, but also maybe as good civic hygiene, you know, to say, look, I don't agree with you, but we don't have to be enemies. And I think certainly in fiction, that's something that I have found happens through revision. You can take somebody who's a pretty deplorable character, and you have the choice of either making a caricature of a bad person or a three-dimensional bad person. And mostly, now maybe not always, you know, but mostly for my purposes, it's more interesting to make a three-dimensional bad person. And, you know, I think what you find along the way is if you actually make a truly three-dimensional bad person, you can often drop the adjective bad. You know, just not because you're trying to be a new age sweetie pie, but just because if you know enough about someone's motivation, I think with probably a few exceptions, I mean, a sociopath might be a good one.
Right.
But even there, you know, if you know enough about someone's motivation, I think that, you know, there's that moment where the quality of judgment drops away and the quality of true understanding comes up. And by understanding, I don't mean approval, but I mean sort of like three-dimensional vision where you're like, oh, yeah, that, you know, that makes sense given the way that the world feels to that person. It makes sense that she would do that thing. I like that. And I sometimes have trouble convincing people of this, but I think it's a very powerful state, even if you have to be in opposition to the other person, because you're basically a mind reader and you can predict, you know, you can really understand why they're doing what they're doing. If your goal was to stop them from doing that thing, I can't think of a better location to be than literally being them for a couple minutes.
Mm.
You know?
Yeah.
So I like that idea, but I'm also thinking, you know, there are wonderful works of fiction that work with, you know, characters of human beings. I mean, actually, I don't know that they're wonderful, but my early stories do a lot of that. That the boss characters are often just complete shitheads.
Right.
So I think, you know, for all of the nice empathetic ideas, we always have to remember that art is something that, you know, it can't be gamed. I mean, it's a very complicated system, and it can work almost on any, you know, any framework, any aesthetic framework. So we don't, you know, you don't want to be in a position of prescribing what art should do or must do. I think that's
sure.
The opposite of artistic thinking.
No, that makes sense. I, you know, it's interesting though, in your piece in the Guardian of what writers really do when they write, which is pretty brilliant, by the way. I really loved it.
Thanks.
And you talk about going through the revision and saying, all right, I've got a character who's kind of a jerk, and I'm going to re-examine the character. I'm just going to like make in what you describe as just making the process better. I think the quote is, I didn't make the series of changes because I wanted the story to be more compassionate. I did it because I wanted the story to be less lame. So as you make the character more understandable for why the character was a jerk to the barista, and he's mourning the loss of his wife and it's Christmas time, and that this makes for not only a more compassionate story, but more directly, it makes for a better story. But what I find, and this is something that's kind of interesting about you as a writer and what you bring to it, is that you go inside a character and say, well, I'm going to really look. And you maybe send a ghost inside a character. And that ghost comes out and goes, oh, my gosh, I know you. And because I know you, I love you. Mm-hmm. Which is saying something actually pretty profound, that people are lovable. I envy that that compassion, because sometimes I find myself so lacking. Sometimes I'm like, oh, if I get too close, if I see too much of that person, oh, I really liked them, and now I'm not going to like them because I've discovered way too much.
And I know what I think I mostly do like people, but I have the same, of course, you know, the same thing. Sometimes people are just nuts, you know, and they're not likable. So I'm not sure that I. Well, maybe it has to do with defining love.
Yeah.
I think one thing that happens in writing is you are trying to make, I think really what I'm trying to do is make the sentences better. And there's this strange mystery where if you start off with a somewhat loose or cliche sentence, and especially in a non-specific sentence, a vague sentence, and you revise it to specificity, that I think is the move.
Mm.
Now, that kind of looks like love because you're looking closer, for one thing, and when you start to put flesh on the bones, somehow, again, the quality of judgment disappears. There's a line in Turgenev, and he's describing, it's kind of a throwaway line, describing this guy. And I think you're supposed to understand the guy is kind of a player. That's the gist, if I remember the story right. But what he does is he doesn't say, you know, Ivan was a player. He says, Ivan had so-and-so had a particular quality, which was whenever he saw a pretty woman walking on the road, he would immediately begin to limp. Right? So that, now, if someone was trying to convey a kind of provincial, you know, self-constructed playboy.
Yeah.
That's a pretty good. I mean, it's also more than that. It's not just that. There's just that's a very particular human being that comes through. Now, do we love that guy? I don't know. I mean, I don't really think that's a lovable trait, but it's certainly specific. So we see him. And I think sometimes that, you know, we also don't, I don't think there's a lot of author-infused judgment in that description. I mean, it's funny, you know, and you kind of, you laugh, but I don't think you like or dislike the guy, but you see him.
Yeah.
So I think that's maybe more, you know, and again, it's not like, it's certainly not the case that I'm love everybody.
Yeah.
You know, and then I just put that in my fiction. It's the other way around. It's that I don't. And I don't like that about myself. And I found that fiction is a good way to sort of use training wheels to make your, maybe, to make your daily mind more inclined to take that extra step to understand the person, you know. Mm. Now, why that should have to do with language, I don't know. But I think it does have to do with specificity. You know, if you lay out two or three things, well-observed things about a person, I think that first pass tendency to judge whether it's positive or negative, to like or not like, I think that goes away a little bit. You know, just like if you see somebody on the street and you watch them a little bit, whatever your initial projections about that person were, it kind of recedes a little bit, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We are talking to George Saunders about his new book, Lincoln and the Bardo, his first novel. And we are here at KUT Studios in Austin, Texas. I'm Owen Edgerton. You're listening to The Write-Up. George, I was going to ask you about Lincoln. It's remarkable how many writers are drawn to Lincoln as a person. And of course, there's been a lot of discussion of why in this time in history we've been drawn to Lincoln as a person. But I was going to ask you, what was it about the voice and the person of Lincoln that made it intriguing? And why do you think we as readers are also so intrigued by this president?
Well, I was not intrigued by him, to be honest. I mean, I grew up in Illinois, and we, you know, he was constantly with us. And so when I heard that first story about him, I suppose I liked it. I liked the Civil War for some reason.
This is the story about him returning to the crypt and holding his son's body.
Right, which I heard 20 years ago, and that was kind of the inciting incident of the book.
Yeah.
So I kind of liked it. I loved the kind of just the mood of that time, actually, you know, the kind of gothic, you know, the nation falling apart. I like that. But my first impulse was, no, Lincoln, no thanks. I don't want to write a novel about Napoleon. I don't want to write one about Jesus or Gandhi. You know, that just seemed too much. So in a sense, I kind of wrote it despite him. And I needed him. You know, he had to be in the book. So that was one of the sort of compositional principles, was to try to keep him out, you know.
Yeah.
We don't exactly follow him around the graveyard. He goes away and comes back. And so, you know, I think part of writing is kind of to be real honest about the challenges and the pain in the asses and the things that you look forward to. And that actually is what structure is. Structure is trying to avoid the stuff you don't want to do and trying to do the things you want to do. You know, so in this case, the structure of the book had to do with, a little bit with keeping Lincoln out.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, I think, why the ghosts sort of are in there. And when he did come in, I always was really mindful of getting him out of there quickly. And also, almost like, what do they say, you know, in screenwriting, you know, somebody, you start the scene late and you leave early, like that kind of idea. So that was one thing. And then, but along the way, you kind of go, actually, you know, it's kind of wonderful to have Lincoln, because I don't have to tell you what he looks like. And I can just take all the things that we know about him. And if you give, you know, if that constitutes 85% of what you know about him, or what you are getting off the page, you just give a couple little details and there you go. You got a Lincoln, you know. There's a part where he leaves the crypt and he's about to go out of the graveyard, but he can't quite leave. So I just have him sitting cross-legged in this long grass.
Mm.
And to me, even that, like the idea of Lincoln sitting cross-legged, which I'm sure he did. I mean, he was a country boy, but he had those big long legs. So I think if a person knows a little bit about Lincoln, and suddenly we have him, you know, plopping down in the middle of some long kind of prairie-like grass on a February night, that image comes to mind pretty quickly, which might not be the case if it was, you know, Morris Stevens or somebody.
Right.
Who's that? We don't know. So I think, so in some ways, you kind of, you know, you avoid the stuff you don't want to do. And if you get a windfall, like, hey, you know, this is a guy everybody...
Everyone's got a picture of, yeah.
Yeah, you can use that, you know. So and maybe it's a little bit like in music, you know, like if you play a real familiar chord progression, people go, okay, I got that. And then if you do something kind of freaky on top of it, like I was thinking about that Wilco song, I'm Trying to Break Your Heart, you know, which has a pretty familiar chord pattern. It goes through the whole song. And then there's all that crazy sound, sonic stuff going on in the background. So, you know, everything you attempt has built-in pitfalls.
Yeah.
And, you know, in some ways you can use those to your advantage if you're willing to admit that they're there.
Well, one of the things I heard you say once at a reading, and I'm going to paraphrase, which means I'll probably just slaughter it. I'll get it all wrong. But I remember you saying that when an idea or emotion is expressed in a language that can't quite contain it, then that's the birth of poetry.
Yes.
That often you'll get into a character's voice. And I'm thinking, for example, like the 400-pound CEO or Sea Oak, where we have a character who maybe doesn't have the verbal skills to express an emotion or wisdom or revelation. And
right.
That's poetry is born out of that.
I think so, yeah. I think there's something, you know, and conversely, you know how sometimes when someone says exactly the right thing in perfectly articulate language, it's kind of a letdown?
Sure,
you know?
It's me and my wife all the time.
Right. I mean, it's every, you know, and it's like the guy who has memorized a million quotes and keeps dropping them. You're like, yeah. for me, I mean, from my background, a lot of the most sincere expressions of emotion came in that mode you know, kind of the emotion being too big for the conveying device. So the language would go a little bit, almost like feedback, you know,
yeah.
There'd be a little bit. And I like that. And I think that's, I mean, if you read the greatest poetry in the world, it's all a little off.
Yeah.
You know, it often isn't syntactically perfect. Or you know, that's why we feel like Whitman is doing new stuff with language, because he was. He was, you know, the language was overflowing the syntactical sluice, so to speak. So, yeah, I think that's I think that's true. You know, and of course, for a writer, it's nice because it means not only can you make that overflow, but that's kind of your job. You
right.
Know, because if language was actually scaled correctly to express all the wonder and fear that we feel, that would be great, but then it wouldn't be language. You know?
Right. I was thinking, though, that must have created a bit of a challenge when you have Lincoln, who is one of the most eloquent public figures in American history,
yes.
and suddenly he... Not only do you have to, I would imagine it was a challenge to discover his voice, but also to seek out the emotions or ideas that would be a challenge to that voice to
right.
create poetry there.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that I said to sort of trick myself was, well, yeah, he's the best, he's probably the greatest American writer of English ever.
Mm.
But he's not writing, he's thinking. So,
right.
So the thing was, I read a lot of Lincoln, and the idea was to kind of get the basic logic. How did he reason? And he was a very syllogistic thinker, so that was a good takeaway. You know, so even in grief, he was going to try to be somewhat logical. So there's a riff in the book where he's actually divided into two people. You know, sort of a kind of a good angel and a bad angel, or the reasonable part of himself and the unreasonable part, and he kind of interrogates himself that way. So I gave myself a lot of leeway in that sense. And then, of course, you know, you're always just really, what can you do but write yourself?
Mm.
So the nice thing about writing Lincoln is you are, you free up the opportunity to write from the best part of yourself, or the most poetic, or the most morally ambitious and all that kind of stuff. So, but again, you know, the only way I could do it was because there was always a timer on it. He wasn't going to get 15 pages.
Right.
You
right.
know, yeah.
I would also imagine writing for Lincoln, of course, who lost his 11-year-old son, and you as a father as well, that must have been just exploring a nightmare.
Yeah, and I just wouldn't go there, to be honest with you. I didn't write it until my kids were older. And even then, I mean, I'm not someone who naturally does a kind of character actor, or what do you call it? The the acting method, you know, character acting.
Right.
I don't have to go, I don't go through and try to be a character when I'm thinking of her or him. That's not how it works. But in this case, what I found was all I needed was to draw on my love for my kids.
Mm.
And in the world of the story, the disaster has already happened to Lincoln. So I'd certainly use a lot of fatherly feelings, you know, the kind of the things you do with your kids, the things you feel, that your hopes for them. But given that Willie had already passed away, you didn't have to do the loss. You just had to do the love.
Mm.
And that momentum would kind of carry forward. So it was, you know, I felt a lot of things in the book. A couple of moments of kind of, you know, like that little sting of tears all of a sudden. But mostly it was the things I felt was that somehow the surface tension we talked about at the beginning was making enough narrative momentum that the sorrow and the humor and all that would be palatable. You know, like you're kind of, it's almost like you're trying to, you know, you're preparing a little bitter food and a little sweet food.
Yeah.
And you're trying to get it past the diner so that they only get a couple bites of it. And they feel those two things in contrast and like, oh, wow, this is a weird restaurant, you know. So that, again, that's sort of structural in a certain way.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah.
Well, that's interesting. That kind of leads me into your use of humor in here. And, of course, you're known for being quite a funny writer. It is pretty fantastic to have a graveyard full of immense grief and a nation at war with itself, and to be in the gravesite of a child, but also to have jokes about good old fashioned penis jokes.
Sure,
in the mix.
Because you know, in the real world, there are kids dying and there are guys with big penises.
Yeah,
and so.
That should be a bumper sticker.
Yeah, probably will be. But the only reason we resist that is because it makes us uncomfortable. It's untidy somehow. So the idea of juxtaposing them, you know, and you know, joy and sorrow and all that stuff, I think we don't mind that in fiction because we know that in real life, these artificial divides between tragedy and comedy, they only exist because we artificially make them.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some way in which, say you read Gogol, same thing, or Shakespeare, or, you know, really, I mean, any Monty Python for that matter, you know, we notice that the juxtaposition of the profound and the low, you know, or the lyrical and the pornographic, we mm-hmm. notice it in an artistic setting, maybe because we're habituated to have them separated.
Right.
But when it's done well, I think we kind of like it, you know, because it does feel that's, you know, that's what's actually outside the window here is all those mixes.
Yeah, we recognize it as alive in a way that a piece that is monotone, it lacks that.
Yeah, I mean, if you ever, you know, when I was a kid, I was a big Khalil Gibran fan and Ayn Rand. So
yeah.
If you go back and look at my notebooks from college, oh my God, they're so serious, you know, so earnest. Oh this and oh that, and you know, nobility must find friends. You know, like this, that kind of. So and you're reading them, and you're like, geez, you know, dude, have you ever been to a frat party? Which I had. You know, did you ever fart? Yeah, I did. So you feel what you don't like about that writing is that it's leaving out entire portions of human experience, and it seemed to have an agenda. And my agenda was some kind of, I don't know what it was, but like a control freak, you know, I don't know, a very moral guy, you know, that. So that's okay, but an intelligent reader feels omission.
Mm.
And especially if the omission is agenda-driven, it's irritating. And it feels like a lie, which it is, you know. So I think that's one of the reasons, I mean, I see a lot of people who have in their personalities, they have a duality. I have it. So I'm very earnest, and I like to be darkly funny.
Yeah.
So I think one of the reasons we teach our students to try to let all of their different components to the table is because that's an approximation of the truth of the universe. I mean, if you are somebody who is, you know, lyrical and guttural, and you can manage to do both of those well and put them in the same story, that's a pretty good simulacrum of the world, which is both lyrical and guttural.
And I suppose in that way then too, it's like the specificity you're talking about with a character. If you are able to point out actual tidbits of a character, then that character becomes more human, and we understand the character, and they become three-dimensional. And I suppose the world is the same way, that when we talk about aspects of the world, that people do take craps, and that sexual frustration is a part of nature, and whatever aspect it is, that the funny parts make for a real world.
Yeah, and of course, now the other thing is true. If all you have is people taking craps, you know, someone says, well, don't they ever go to the opera? You know, there's, so I think, but of course, now to take it one step further, the other tricky thing is there's no, I mean, ultimately, we're trying to make a work of art that has a lot of energy. That's what we're trying to do. And in a sense, all we're really doing is we're kind of counting on the fact that even a passing resemblance to the real world is thrilling for a reader. Mm. So I don't think it's the case that you're making an exact scale model.
Right.
And in fact, you're making a scale model that has a lot to do with just what tools you have personally as a writer. So it's I don't know. I mean, the thing I like about art is, and I'm a teacher and I'm an artist, but mostly I think I'm an artist. And what I like is that you actually can't reduce what art is. It's always something new. And you think, you know, of course, everybody has an aesthetic theory, and especially if you're, you know, supporting a book on tour or something, you develop this aesthetic shtick, and an aesthetic shtick develops around the book based on what you said and all that. But I think it's really fun then to go home and go, okay, that was all an approximation. And the next work, there's no rules and there's no agenda and there's not even any real program. You know, you're just going to sit down and see if you can make something that comes alive again. And that's always kind of refreshing. You know, it's almost like if you developed a comprehensive theory of love, you know, and talked about it a bunch, and then you suddenly, across the room, your eyes meet somebody, and you're like, oh, that's it, you know. So that's always nice.
Is it more difficult now? I mean, you know, the quotes about you must be, in some ways, difficult to read. You know, the American treasure, a luminous feat of generosity and human, like, people so
those are so easy to read. The other ones that aren't so great.
But is it difficult now when you do go back in and you sit with your work, is there an idea like, oh my gosh, I have a lot of people. How do you shut out those voices that you know are eager to read what you're going to be writing?
Yeah, well, you know, a couple things. One is, up until this time, I've always had something started. Like when I toured 10th of December, this book was already started. Mm. So I had the relief of saying, I'm going to just go read that 10 pages of that Lincoln book, and the DNA of it will speak to me, and I don't have to worry about anything.
Right.
So I don't have anything started right now. So it's a little problem. But, you know, one answer is just I've been doing this a long time.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like if someone was talking about, a baseball player or something, when you get up to the plate, your muscle memory takes over a bit. The other thing I'm noticing on this tour is that actually, you know, the praise, but especially the interaction that you have with readers when you're signing or something, that's an incredible gift, because this book was a stretch for me. Mm. And the thing I kept, you know, asking myself was, will the reader who liked Civil War Land, with all its darkness and all its, you know, kind of exaggerated edge, will they think I've wimped out? You know, will they think that I've become, you know, too straight or something?
Mm-hmm.
But from meeting so many people, I was like, no, I don't think so. I think they, you know, they responded to the stuff in 10th of December that was a little more tender. In talking to them, I got a sense that they have a lot of affection for my work, and I think they'll follow me. So then to write the book on that basis, go out and see that they did, it's actually really empowering. So there is certainly that sense of like, geez, you know, what do I do next? But basically I got kind of a quiet confidence from years of doing it that, you know, your artistic mind, your subconscious or whatever, it's got an agenda, you know, that it's almost like a stone rolling downhill, and you really can't stop it. So whatever my artistic self wants to do, it's already, it's already developing it for me. I got to show up and receive it. And then that, along with this idea that, you know, so far people have stayed with me, and, you know, and then finally just the idea that if I really fuck it up, I had a pretty good run.
Well, let me ask you about that. You have this great quote in the Guardian piece about what writers really do when they write. The empathetic function in fiction is accomplished via the writer's relation both to his characters and his readers. And that occurred to me. I was thinking, oh, I wonder what you have in mind when you think of your reader. I know Kurt Vonnegut would talk about every writer should have one reader in mind. And for him, it was his sister who was dead at the time when he said it. But the idea that we have a reader in mind that we're talking to. Who's your reader?
Well, for me, it's me if I hadn't read it already.
Mm.
That's really the truth. And I say in that context that, you know, you're always trying to imagine your reader up. You're trying to imagine the reader as being as smart as you, as worldly, as, you know, whatever. But functionally, you know, what I do when I revise, I just read the thing I wrote yesterday, playing the part of somebody who hasn't seen it before.
Mm.
And of course, you can't really be that person, but you can kind of get pretty close. So that's really what I'm doing. It isn't thinking of a particular person, although my wife is important in that process because I always give her something in progress when I feel like I've reached a certain level of polish. And the thing that I treasure about her reading is that she reads it very both generously and harshly. She wants to be moved by it, and she wants me not to be bullshitting around with just being clever. She wants it to have emotional heft. So if she responds positively, I, you know, it's good. But I don't really aim it towards her exactly. I mean,
yeah.
Sometimes I can feel myself making a little move and going, she's not going to like that a little bit. But mostly it's me, you know, if I hadn't read it a million times already. And I think, again, it's a simulation of that. It's not, you can't actually do it, but it's like, you know, that thing where I'm not a doctor, but I play one on TV. You know, you can kind of do that. But I think in that process, you're doing this, the other thing, which is if I'm pleasing myself and I'm holding a high standard, then when you read it, you're going to feel that I considered you as dear as me.
Right.
You know, yeah, I considered you as smart as me and as all that. So I think it's kind of two ways of saying the same thing, I think.
I love what you say, though, about the idea that you're expecting it's a compliment to your reader that not only are you saying I'm trying to give you something that I consider beautiful, but you're also saying I believe that you are capable of enjoying this. It sounds.
Yeah. And also the other thing is the idea that I think I say this in that Guardian piece, that if I'm writing here and I cut an extra word that really doesn't do any work, the assumption is that you feel that over there.
Yeah.
You feel the absence of that redundant word, and that improves our relationship a little bit.
Mm.
And I think, again, whether that's actually true in every case, I don't know, but as a kind of a writing hygiene thing, it's great. Because you know why? Because it gives you a basis for being responsible for every punctuation mark and every pause in your piece. You know, if you can look at version A and version B and go, you know, it's better without the comma.
Mm.
Then if you feel that, which we all, I mean, people who are language people are capable of feeling that,
yeah.
I think, then I do it, and you feel it over there. Now,
yeah.
Even if you don't agree with it, you feel it as an assertion of artistic will,
mm.
And I think you like that. I think you like the, you know, the feeling of us being sort of in tight communication like that. So whether it's true or not, it gives me a way to proceed, you know. And it's also true that, you know, for every writer has their own version of that. So, I think some people are better at thinking in terms of rhythmic clusters, you know, five or six sentence clusters and how that is. But it seems to me like the most vital thing for an artist is something about which you have a strong opinion.
Hmm.
Because then you can proceed with some confident joy. Whereas for me, the worst times in writing are when I just don't really care.
Yeah.
There's something I'm like, I don't know, I have no idea. Writing in the wrong mode. And none of your opinions will come to the surface, and you just then what happens? I think is you tend to start revising on the basis of some concept, which to me is always a weaker mode.
A concept is a dangerous place to be writing from, or concept or from theme. Would you say too?
Yes, same, exactly. Or you know, your agenda.
I'm
going to prove this or demonstrate that. But again, I mean, not the that Guardian piece. You know, that was their headline. You know what? What writers do when they write. I would say this is what I do when I write.
Right.
It certainly isn't universal, as I know, and I'm sure you do from teaching. You know, it's anything that gets the boat into the harbor is good piloting.
Yeah. We're talking to George Saunders about his novel Lincoln and the Bardo. Well, the next question is the audiobook. It's about the audiobook. So I was reading the book and listening to the audiobook, and I was able to sort of do both. The audiobook is really fantastic. It involves, I think, a cast of, oh gosh, the cast is read off. It must be 50 to 100?
It's 166.
166
yeah.
in the cast.
Yeah.
And which is great, including a number of people from your own family, and some heavy hitters. There's Bill Hader, David Sedaris, Nick Offerman. It's pretty fabulous. Jeff Tweedy does the music. Mm-hmm. How did
and
that...
He also does a long part on there, too. He does Lieutenant Prince, I think his name is.
Really? The Civil War soldier who...
Yeah.
Oh, gosh, that's a heartbreaking section. How did that come to be? What was the process of taking the book and making it into not just an audiobook, but a production?
Well, I wish I could take some credit, but there's a woman in L.A. named Kelly Gilday who works for Random House, and we had done that 10th of December book together and really had a great time, and she's really wonderful. So she at one point she just called and said, you know, well, time to do the audiobook, and I was like, oh, my God, I don't want to do it. It's just there's too many voices. I can't do that many voices. So it's just going to sound like me intoning these different things, And also, you know, for me, part of the fun of writing the book was to at least try to make the illusion of there being all these different presences, you know, which in the book I kind of did it through partly through voice, but also through typography. There's one of the riffs is that when you hear a ghost speaking, you're actually seeing the way that person would have written in life. So there's different letters of literacy and different sort of typographical right. habits, like somebody uses a lot of ampersands or whatever. So that didn't, you know, so I thought it would be cool to mimic that by having different voices that you could just, not that they were thespianized, but just the difference between your voice and my voice, a person registers that, even if we're just talking in a normal way.
Mm-hmm.
So I suggested something like that to her, and she just, I don't know, you know, she just went off and decided to make this a huge project and came back with a spreadsheet that's how we know there's 166 people, and she had it all separated out by gender and everything. And then I don't know, it was kind of just magical. We got David Sedaris and Nick Offerman to agree, and then it was like the floodgates were open, and I talked to a few other people, actors that I knew, and to Jeff and some other people. So it was just kind of this, I mean, and nobody got compensated adequately, for sure.
Yeah.
And then we went to a second tier of, not a lower tier, but of the audiobook professionals that Kelly knew about, and then that still wasn't enough, so we went to my friends and family and people at Random House, and it became kind of this really, you know, almost like that in the old, the old Hollywood musicals. We're putting on a show, and just everybody. Yeah, I'm in. So we got, and it was done quickly. I think it was done maybe in a couple months. In 10 or 15 different studios all over the country. And
I like to think that all 166 were just in one studio.
No, in fact,
passing a book around and
nobody was ever in the studio at the same time. That's the thing. So when I went in, I do this guy called the Reverend, and I just went in to the LA office and spent about a six-hour day there just reading all of his parts. And so that means there's an engineer and Kelly who the engineer put it all together, including all these sound effects. And then also Kelly was there to kind of coach you as you're reading your lines. She's like, well, actually, you want to emphasize this word based on the preceding line. She read the book, I think, five or six times, and she had it in her mind easily as firmly as I did. She could run it down and tell you what tone of voice you should be using. So really, if the audiobook is good, it's all to her credit.
Oh, that's great. Well, it is pretty wonderful. You know, you mentioned that you performed or read the part of the Reverend, which of course is a haunting character in himself. It kind of leads me to another question that I had. There's a small book by C.S. Lewis. It's a large book concept wise, but it's a brief book, The Great Divorce, in which he imagines kind of a Christian bardo, where basically he imagines the residents of hell are permitted to take a holiday
to the outskirts of heaven, and there they are visited by loved ones or people they knew from their life, and urged to journey the distance into heaven. And I was thinking about that. I was thinking about that in comparison to your book and your book, where you created your own mythology, your own afterlife, but of course borrowing from all these different traditions and the concept, of course, Tibetan Buddhism and the Bardo. But I was curious about that. Specifically, I was curious about the concept of damnation in Buddhism. Is there a concept of damnation in Buddhism? And forgive me for not being more versed.
Well, also, forgive me, I'm going to tell you an answer, but I want to qualify that, especially if there's any real Buddhists listening, that I'm not any kind of scholar about it. And, you know, refer people to the Tibetan Book of the Dead or the work of a wonderful writer named Toku Tondup, who's written on this stuff. But, yeah, there is. There is definitely hell. And also there's a book by Sam Burkholz, who is a guy I know really well, and he's a wonderful practitioner, and he actually, in his life, had this book is about the fact that he actually has died twice in his life, and once he went to heaven, and once he didn't. So my limited understanding of it is that basically, you know, in the Tibetan Buddhist sense, you kind of you make your afterlife by the way your mind works here. So, and one of the things that it says in this book by Toku Tonup is that, you know, if you are a strong Christian and you have spent your life praying and meditating in a Christian sense, then, of course, you know, when you die and your mind is in this kind of super free, exaggerated state, you would, of course, imagine things happening in a Christian context. You'd see Jesus and maybe you'd see Satan. So same in Buddhism. If you're someone who's practiced Tibetan Buddhism, there's a lot of visualization, then when you died, you would see it in those terms, and you know every tradition that I read about in their after death literature, there's a judgment scene, which we us liberal humanists don't like to think that, but I've heard it. I seem to remember that someone had made some suggestions that there's some neurological way in which the what we might call the conscience or the part of us that is always sort of berating ourselves a little bit or correcting ourselves, that may sort of have a role in that, you know, at the end. So the interesting thing is, whatever your idea about the afterlife is, whether it's, you know, pure Christian epistemology, or it's, you know, Freudian, or it's materialist, or it's whatever it is, I think most traditions agree that, you know, you, Owen, are going to go through something. And whether, you know, you can say now, oh, well, that's just a... you know, that's just an incredible brain surge that takes place in the last 10 minutes of your life, or it's this or it's that. The people who've come back from those states, if you believe them, that doesn't really matter, you know. In other words, if you stub your toe, someone can say, oh, that's just nerve endings.
Right.
But it really hurts, you know. So to me, I don't really know. I mean, of course, you have no way of knowing what happens or why or any of that. But I think I do take some comfort in the thought that if you take care of your mind right now, and you turn to it and you try to understand it, and you try to, over the course of your life, influence it towards positive phenomenon, then that's got to be, I would think, that would have to be better for you. Whatever happens, even if nothing happens, you know, you're better off if you've trained yourself in, you know, love and happiness and patience and so on.
Let me ask you one last question, George. How did writing this book change you?
Well, one thing it did was, you know, we started off talking about form, and I'm more confident that my instincts in that way are okay, and also that I'm finding that as I'm writing longer and longer, form and style are becoming tools to permit me to be as positive in writing as I am in life. You know, so early on, I think my crimped tool set made me write stories that were darker than I was. I don't think they're untrue. They're like a pretty good representation of the dark part of my mind, the fearful, or also maybe just the part that sees it things don't always go well, you know. But now I'm feeling kind of a hunger to make a bigger, more accurate world in which the beauty and the horror are both, you know, set on 11, basically. And so I think writing this book and the reception of it, the generous reception of it, has made me think, okay, yeah, so just keep moving on that area. Don't be fearful about it. Don't sort of downsize your ambition, but go the other way. That's really what it has done. You know, it made me feel like maybe my basic instincts are okay, and this subconscious that you know, in my view, operates a little separately from us as individuals. It has something in mind, and part of my, you know, the artistic stance is to kind of get out of the way a little bit, and so what that means to me is having in the very short term pragmatic thing is to allow myself to have the highest ambition I can, you know, conceptualize, and hope for the best in that way.
You know, I suppose it occurs to me, I suppose it, in the same way that if we're taking care of our mind, as you suggested, that in a way we're prepping what could be our afterlife, a possibility. Like we are almost in the process of writing or crafting our afterlife in the way we take care of our subconscious life now. And I wonder, in a way, there's a similarity of like the best way to approach our craft is partially craft, but in even a deeper sense is to take care of our life.
I think you're absolutely right, and that's a beautiful way of putting it. You know, I'm older than you, but I expect we sort of shared a lot of the same aesthetic shaping influences. And one thing I'm aware of is that in that, I was in grad school in the 80s, mid-80s, and there was, and I remember, and I think David Foster Wallace has written about this, there was kind of a sense of, being afraid of earnestness, not wanting to be too sentimental, a sense that dark truths and dark comedy were somehow more sophisticated than other things. And I think actually that can be very true. You know, there's a lot of schmaltz that was being excised by that movement. But I know that for me, it's been interesting to feel some of that. Well, to feel that in real life, there's a certain set of attitudes I've learned and I believe in that have to do with kind of, you know, positive valences, trusting in somebody else, even if they're against you, trusting that underneath they really want to be happy just as you do, all those kind of things. So I think what you're saying is just right. If we feel that we reflexively are being snarky or negative or sardonic or sarcastic in our work, not because we actually believe in that approach, but because we've been trained into it and we're not sure we can do anything else, then that would be a good thing to push up against. Because what I found is that even in my day-to-day life, the ambient assumption that people are stinkers who trend to the negative and are trying to get you and are thinking mean things about you, let's say that's the way your mind is set, that's not actually 100% accurate. And I found in my life that if you as I'm getting older, and I think teaching has something to do with it, you can do that little move where you imagine that inside that person is somebody just like you. That actually changes your experience. I notice that sometimes in when I'm signing books, a young person, often a guy, will give me this look as he approaches that 10 years ago I would have thought meant he hates my work. You know, he's a real hipster boy. He really, you know. And then but I know from experience that isn't the case. He's nervous. So when I say, hey, how are you doing, and make a joke, suddenly the expression goes away. So now I'm not trying to be Pollyannish, but I think to your point, if we could train the reflexive negative expectation out of ourselves, especially the reflexive incorrect negative, whatever it was, then that's good. And I think that would actually benefit us in the afterlife, I think, but certainly would benefit us in this one as well. So I guess what I'm saying is we want our art to be as truthful as it can be. And the difficult stretch for somebody like me is to make sure that truthfulness does justice to the positive valences of life in a way that isn't schmaltzy or sentimental.
We've been talking to George Saunders, author of Lincoln and the Bardo. George,
Thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us.
Oh, I enjoyed it so much. And on a long tour, a talk like this is such a great energizer. So thank you for those great questions.
Oh, thank you. Well, have a great rest of the tour. Hope you enjoy Dallas.
Okay, thank you, brother.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Write-Up with Owen Edgerton. The Write-Up is a KUT production. It's produced by Rebecca McEnroy, engineered by David Alvarez, and Felix Morgan is our new social media intern. And I said social media intern because I didn't know what to say. Like, what? Sounded pretty, like, I hear those things. Do you like that title? No, you don't like that title?
Okay.
What's a better title? I think George Saunders is going to go, they have a social media intern? Those guys are huge.
We're all just running around social media.
She could be our alternate fact checker.
Yes, I'll make up alternative facts, like original ones. Flash them.
A personal assistant to Owen Edgerton. That's what I should have said. Owen Edgerton's hair done by Felix Morgan. Actually, gosh, George Saunders has great hair. My gosh.
He does have good hair.
Really, you had an hour to think of a title. The fact that you didn't put one over to me.
Well, I was just, it was too grandiose. Like, I was like, pirates. Well,
you're making
first
little pictures.
Mate. Look, I illustrated him. Aesthetic shticked.